Let me introduce my speakers. Of course, you have their CV here, so I don't say everything which is written there. Elazar Barkan is professor of international and public affairs and director of the human rights concentration at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. I saw, and I find this extremely interesting and important, that he does not only study conflict resolution, but also tries to work on reconciliation with actors from both sides. And stress is also something which is very important in my working field, for example, the Middle East conflict, the different narratives of conflicts and stories, especially in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mean, we have this clash of narratives every single day, even now in the development in the of peace talks or non-peace talks and so on. My second speaker is Ian Levine. He's a program director at Human Rights Watch, and you are responsible there for research and reporting work, as I understand. Mr. Levine has been in Sudan and also in Mozambique. And yes, also we should mention that you have been the representative of Amnesty International to UN and UNICEF. So I just ask you for your presentations, please.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me. And I'll make some comments. When I was thinking of what I'm going to say, given the fact that it's one text being, it's the third session on a text, a lot has been said already, and I would hate to repeat it. So instead of beginning with the text, let me begin with the context. In the late 70s, 350,000 Vietnamese and Laotian refugees were scattered in camps from Thailand to Hong Kong. Another 500,000 Cambodians were stranded on the Thai border. By 1978, Malaysia started to push the boat people back to sea. It marked a new effort to deny entry by countries in the region. Pirates exploited and plundered the refugees. The number who perished in the flight remained unknown, but people speak about 100,000 and more. So, contrary to many other crises, this one stimulated an enormously positive response by the West. And in a session that was in Geneva in 79, 65 governments met and pledged to resettle 250,000 refugees. In response, part of that agreement was that Vietnam promised to try and halt illegal departures and initiate an orderly departure program. So regional reprocessing centers were established, and the countries of first asylum accepted refugees on the expressed promise that they would not be left burdened with the refugees. So their shores remain open in return for an open door in the West. In the following 2 years, 500,000 Indochinese refugees were resettled. And over the next 5 years, departures gradually fell to a trickle. So this was a crisis that resolved with international cooperation. Hospitality showed its nice face. However, a new upsurge in Vietnamese departures began in 87, surged dramatically in 88, and the open door policy was now seen as a magnet for attracting others to flee while humanitarian fatigue set in. So the response was another international conference in Geneva. This time in 89, and the outflow of refugees was now dubbed illegal migration. So it's no longer refugees. The assembled parties adopted a comprehensive plan of action, the CPA, that allow resettlement only for the few eligible under the very narrow legal definition of convention refugees. Only those who could prove that they had well-founded fear of persecution would qualify. Those rejected would be repatriated. The convention, the refugee convention, now becomes the rationale for abuse of the displaced. So the UNHCR initiated mass information campaign to deter refugees. The organized smugglers were pursued. Governments were once again pushing boats back to sea, reclassifying those who fled as illegal immigrants. And those found not to be convention refugees were returned to their home countries. At the end of the Cold War, the Comprehensive Peace of Action was part of a general strategy to deter asylum seekers and defined most as illegal immigrants. The organized repatriations of unwanted refugees, now defined as illegal migrants, became an integral part of the UNHCR mandate. This end of asylum in Southeast Asia in 1989 has remained largely the global policy ever since. And in the past two decades, the restrictions of refuge has only been intensified. And although millions of refugees would-be refugees are denied asylum or hospitality, millions are obviously enjoy it. So the question is, how do we look at it? My claim is that the questions of refuge or hospitality as a right and as a policy has to be seen as a political issue. While it is often discussed as a question of individual rights, it is foremost a question of policies concerning groups. The vast majority of refugees, migrants, and the displaced for any number of reasons, from political violence to natural disasters, are uprooted because the group they belong to suffers a disaster. Most people are uprooted for reasons that have little to do with them personally. Addressing the need for protection and asylum as individual matter shifts attention away from the social and political causes of the displacement. For Kant, I knew I'll get to him, asylum and hospitality focuses primarily on individuals, and it is individuals who are the subjects of moral and legal rights and not groups. Yet it is critical to recognize, I think, that the real challenge is of displaced populations. To make my point clear, let me make a plug for a forthcoming book that I wrote, which is called No Return, No Refuge. Rights, R-I-T-E-S, and Rights, G-H, in Minority Repatriation. And to state simply, what the book argues is that displaced minorities have never been able to be repatriated based on the claims of rights. And if return is impossible, the question of hospitality becomes that much more critical. So the question for hospitality, I think, is that it necessitates political backing. The growing restriction of migrations and the policing of displacement takes place in a world where the demand for refuge and hospitality outstrips the available space, precisely the predicament described by Kant that demanded hospitality in the first place. But this is not a new situation. Indeed, the International Conference in Evian in 1938 aimed at finding refuge for Jewish refugees escaping Nazi Germany was the low point of international solidarity before World War II. But this was the low point, not the beginning. The international regime of regulating the flow of refugees began at the end of World War I and is associated, obviously, with the work of Nansen and the Nansen passport. Ever since, it's largely been a frustrated story of demand outstripping opportunities. So how does Kant's view on hospitality relate to the status of migrations and refugees? What can we take from it today? I'm not going to go through the three definitive articles that we have talked about, but what I want to emphasize is that this is a comprehensive system that he talks about, and it really, the peace and the security are the precondition for the availability or the ability of hospitality. So rather than talk about it in an idealist terms and talk about separated as though hospitality is independent of world order, it's the question of security that we talked previously, and in that I will in a friendly joiner to Pablo before, would argue that the sequencing may be actually necessary here, that without a security as a precondition, the hospitality cannot actually, at least from Kant's perspective, would not have been provided as a notion. Now, let me say a couple of words about the anomaly of the hospitality as a right. The right of asylum is asserted by non-citizens against a government with which the asylum seeker is hoping to establish a relationship. This is obviously contradictory to most of the rights that we talk about, where the rights of individuals are entertained against vis-a-vis their own government, not vis-a-vis a different government. And it goes to the heart of the disjuncture between civil and human rights. It employs the language of rights, but it belongs in a liminal space between politics and ethics. The aspiration is to regulate entry for outsiders into the system based on the notions of fellow human feeling. This aspiration is abstract without explicating any principles according to which the regulations will be implemented. The aspirations convey desire for social justice, ethics, and universal fellow feeling, but leaves politics unaddressed. Kant envisions the international system as based on collaboration among democracies, as we've mentioned several times, and hospitality, therefore, is seen as part of a system of free democracies where physical and economic security is well established and where there is no fundamental disequilibrium. The question is, what do we do, to quote Obama, when we have to face the real world in which the ones that we find it? The form of orderly democratic governments around the world is fundamental to the existence of the norm of hospitality. And in this regard, I think that we need to emphasize that Kant, I don't see Kant as a naive. So the dilemma that we face is the dilemma of democracy and the rejections of hospitality. Because not all countries are obviously the object of migration. The countries that are most desired, the desired destinations, are democracies. So we have those, it's not the failed states that are the desired destinations. Yet it is those democracies that increasingly reject asylum seekers. Kant presents a rational view of the world which he claims will win because this is a human nature. And we spoke before, and I mentioned the comment earlier about the notions of plurality, that it's really unimaginable now for us to think that we will just agree on everything. Perhaps the most appropriate context for the anomaly of the hospitality is often the oft-quoted statement by Arendt, that warning that naked humanity is no protection at all. Just being human without civil rights, without national rights, is just no protection at all. This is, so human rights on its own, and that's sort of, in some ways, became the standard. But despite the enhanced mechanism to assist the displaced, the number of unprotected displaced who face neither refuge nor any help is increasing. Hospitality is further from the reach of ever-increasing numbers. The dilemma that the right of refugee to seek asylum is not guaranteed by any correlative duty of states to grant asylum, certainly not by the 51 Convention or later, is at the heart of the problem of speaking about it as a right. The international practice of states has been consistently to erect higher legal and physical barriers to deny the undesirable from being able to seek asylum. We all remember, I mean, there are many examples, but perhaps I should just remind us the example of the U.S. and the Haitian boat people in Guantanamo, earlier incarnation as an incarceration outpost. The advocacy world for refugees often focuses on individual cases of oppression, on fighting to extend asylum to cultural rights such as FGM, but not on the structural imbalance. Perhaps this lack of focus is because it's such an impossible to manageable, or not manageable solution. So there, we go back to the text of Kant. Kant refers to the founding fathers of international law as miserable comforters. He says in the text that we all read, right, that when he talks about Grotius and others, the risk is that the rupture between the aspirations of the international system, whether through conventions or other mechanisms, and the scarcity of political solutions for the displaced and the deprived, is that hospitality will grow ever farther away. Kant does not refer to institutional structure. In this, the derision for the international lawyers who have no impact is left hanging, and I'm afraid that Kant is being associated with the same miserable comforters that he's so critical of. Let me conclude perhaps by saying that the hospitality is presented as an aspiration for a right based on needs. The existence of a skeletal framework and declarations, which often is ignored and circumvented by robust political system, amount to the denial of migration and asylum. Rights without political backing underscore the nature of its miserable comfort. A liberal desire for hospitality that is overwhelmed by inequality and the lack of commitment to implement moral aspirations doesn't bode well. The dilemma is it, and that's what I asked beforehand, and I'll just end with a similar question for all of us for the conversation, is it a hypocrisy, pragmatism, or resignation to accept the notion that a rhetorical right and a claim that it exists while it does not? Is the global society better for having an aspiration? Does the aspiration matter to the tens of or hundreds of millions who are denied the right that supposedly exists? And do the individual successful cases of implementing asylum ameliorate or aggravate the situation to the rest who are denied it? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. There were, of course, was a richness of different issues you brought up. If I understand you right, you share the opinion of one of the speakers in the film that Kant is dépassé, but for different reasons, in a way, no, than he did. Yes, please.
I wouldn't say dépassé in the sense that I think that the challenge, it presents a challenge for us. The question is, why do we go back to a text that is 200 years old? So the question is not whether, the judgment is not about Kant, but the questions of what the content that he has that can actually enrich our conversation. So the point is to take from it without reverence what we can benefit from it. But
And many other things, of course, you said you mentioned the desired destinations of refugees and asylum seekers, but so many of them end up also in countries they didn't want to go there. I mean, we don't even speak about those. I mean, a student of mine just wrote a thesis on Somali refugees in Yemen, no? And this is incredible. This is one step more. So please, I ask Ian for his...
Thank you. Maybe I'll start by trying to answer the question you posed at the end. I mean, because it's central to the work of human rights activism. Does aspiration matter? How does one deal with aspirations that are so far from reality? And to what extent does the existence of that aspiration cover up the fact that governments or others are failing to meet their obligations and the rights of individuals. One of the countries I was looking at in preparation for this session was Greece, which I'll talk about in a couple of minutes. It has one of the most appalling records today globally on the treatment of migrants and asylum seekers and potential refugees. They have an appallingly bad asylum claims mechanism, one that rejects 99.95% of the applicants. In recent times, 30,000 people have applied for asylum in Greece, and only 11 have been granted that asylum. Now, it has, and I'll come to talk about it in a second, very important implications, not just for Greece and how we perceive Greece, but for the entire European Union, because this whole process is tied up with the Dublin II, this process created by the European Union, effectively to seek to prevent migrants and asylum seekers from making their way to Europe. As activists, we're constantly asking ourselves, do we see such ineffective systems, or do we see governments which ratify international conventions with no interest at all in respecting them as covering up and creating a facade that allows people to believe that progress can be made, and do we call their bluff on that, or do we seek to take advantage of the existence of commitments and mechanisms to push for them to work? I've always argued as a human rights activist that we need, for example, to push governments to ratify human rights treaties, even if we don't expect them to fulfill them. Because once a government has made that commitment, at least it gives us a different kind of conversation with the government. Because then you can say, you've ratified this damn thing, now you've got to live up to it. Whereas a total failure to ratify a treaty or to create a mechanism makes it much harder, I think, to push for activism. But no doubt we'll come back more to that. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for allowing me to be here. I'm neither lawyer nor philosopher, and I feel something of a fraud. But I was very happy to have the opportunity to reread Kant, which is something I haven't done for probably 30 years. And to realize how much he was a human rights activist, not just a human rights philosopher or a thinker on human rights, but really an activist. As Kwame Appiah, who was in the film here, said in the introduction to his wonderful new book on moral campaigns, Kant argued that morality is ultimately practical, and though it matters morally what we think and feel, at its heart, morality is what we do and how we act. And as someone who works for human rights advocacy organization, that was inspiring. Let me say a word on the scale of the problem. Eliza has spoken very well and better than I would have done on many of the issues. But maybe just a word on what Kant would find if he were to come back and look at the scale of foreigners. There are something like almost 45 million forcibly displaced people in the world today, of whom about 27 million remain within the borders of their country, and over 15 million are refugees in the sense that they have crossed an international border. In 2009, there were nearly 1 million individual asylum claims. And according to the UN, there are over 200 million migrant workers globally. So if Kant were to come back today, I think he would be astounded by the scale of the issue, because it's something that would have been unimaginable in his own day. And yet, despite the interconnectedness of the globe today, through foreign travel, a globalized economy, a technology that allows us to see into other countries and other cultures and to connect with others, I think it would shock Kant profoundly the fact that the development of international standards and institutions, the increased knowledge and awareness of other countries and other locations, and the globality of international media and international discourse had not moved us forward in the way that he would have expected it to. The laws that we have internationally and nationally remain extremely weak, as you pointed out, I think, so well in your presentation. Although the Universal Declaration of Human Rights creates a right to seek asylum, and the 1951 Refugee Convention stresses that one cannot be returned to a place of persecution, there is no binding obligation on governments to offer asylum. And as I'll try and mention in a minute, that creates extraordinarily difficult situations for many of those who are seeking asylum. In addition, as Eliza pointed out so well, whereas the 1951 Refugee Convention was created to address issues of individual persecution on the basis of political beliefs or race or religion or so on, the refugee and forced displacement flows that we see today are much more around membership of a group, and the international system and the international standards are weak in handling them. Kant, if he came back today, would be not only, I think, disappointed at the weakness of our laws and the failure of our laws to offer the kind of protection that his ideals would expect, but he would be deeply disappointed to see the way in which so many foreigners, be they migrants, migrant workers, asylum seekers, or refugees, have to throw themselves at national level at the mercy of inadequate laws, poor protection, very little policing, and frequently no accountability whatsoever. And I'll try and give a few examples in a moment from Human Rights Watch's own work. In addition, I think he would have been horrified, as I think everyone around this table is, that the concept of the other, the dangerous stranger, the foreigner, remains so strong. There is a very frightening piece in The Guardian today, the London Guardian. I know there are several people here from Europe, so many of you may have seen this already, and I hope will be as shocked as I am. Not shocked in the sense of surprise, but shocked in the sense of horrified. A piece talking about the way in which far-right parties in many countries in Europe are exploiting the fear of the other in pushing extreme anti-immigrant measures. And what's frightening is not just that the far right is doing that. That is no surprise, I think, to any of us in this room, but the extent to which mainstream parties in several countries in Europe, including Denmark, the Netherlands, and Italy, have made coalitions and alliances with these far-right parties, such that they are sitting in governments today. And the failure of centre and centre-left parties to confront these extreme movements is clearly deeply frightening and no doubt would be deeply shocking to Kant. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of Human Rights Watch research, so what I thought I would do is just read out a dozen titles of some recent work that we have done around refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants, and try and draw a couple of points from that. Without Protection, How the Lebanese Justice System Fails Migrant Domestic Workers. Hellish Work, Exploitation of Migrant Tobacco Workers in Kazakhstan. Saudi Arabia, Stop the Execution of Domestic Worker, Migrant Domestic Worker. Kuwait, For Abused Domestic Workers, Nowhere to Turn. France, Reject Anti-Roma Bill. Greece, Asylum Delays Unacceptable. Libya, End Live Fire Against Suspected Boat Migrants. Australia, End Suspension of Asylum Claims. The Netherlands, Do Not Deport Somalis. Spain, Migrant Children at Risk. Kenya, Police Abuse Somali Refugees. Just a snapshot picked randomly of work done in the last year around issues of refugee migrant worker protection. And a couple of things I think sort of are very striking. One is that governments which are themselves rights respecting, which are themselves democracies, which have the rule of law, independent judiciaries, a free press, and all the other pillars that we regard as essential for the respect of and guarantees of human rights, are engaging in awful, appalling practices, from deportation back to extremely dangerous places, such as Somalia, or extraordinary discrimination. One might not be surprised at the news that Saudi Arabia plans to execute a domestic migrant worker who was alleged to have committed a murder at the age of 17, an age which international law does not allow executions for. But that so many of the countries featured here are rights-respecting countries, in general terms, for their own populations, but clearly not for the foreigner. You made the point in your presentation that we shouldn't be surprised by that, in the sense that clearly those who are fleeing situations of war, of persecution, of extraordinary poverty, are going to seek countries with better prospects, with better economies, so they are not going to flee towards Somalia. Clearly, they are going to flee towards more developed countries that potentially offer them more possibilities, and which, you know, they presumably hope to find better rights protection. There are exceptions to that, obviously, in the sense that many of the neighbouring countries face problems, and I want to neighbouring to failed states. And I want to come to that in a minute, but I really just want to make this point about the extent to which rights-respecting countries are so implicated in the failure of Kant's vision when it comes to cosmopolitan rights. Let me just say a couple of things about some of the sort of complexities of this. I want to talk about burden sharing. It's a phrase that's often used in kind of refugee circles, a recognition that certain countries bear the burden of refugee flows. And there are perhaps two, we'll give two examples. Let's talk about Kenya. Kenya borders Somalia and is close to a whole series of other failed states or states in conflict in the region. The Dadaab refugee camp up near the Somali border has something like 350,000 refugees. It's the largest refugee camp in the world. There are many, many abuses of Somali refugees that we have documented, both on the border, as they cross the border, between the border and the refugee camp itself. It's something like 40 kilometers, as far as I recall. And en route, refugees are frequently beaten, abused, sexually abused, robbed, often by the authorities themselves, by Kenyan police. Once refugees reach the camps, lack of protection within the camps, again, often means that abuse, including sexual abuse, is rife and it's rampant. It is very easy to criticize the Kenyan government. And I can say that because we at Human Rights Watch, have criticized the Kenyan government repeatedly and very strongly, as we do. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge and recognize the failure of the international community to support the burden that Kenya faces on the border of a failed state, a state that, as you all know, has been a failed state since 1991 and shows little prospect of unfailing, if such a word exists. So the question of burden sharing, I think, is absolutely critical, particularly for states that are themselves already poor. Greece, as I mentioned before, we have very publicly criticized Greece ourselves for the failure of its asylum policy, for its appalling ill-treatment of those migrants and asylum seekers who are detained in conditions that my colleagues have visited and found inhuman and inhumane, and for their secret expulsion of migrants and asylum seekers, frequently without having had recourse to any kind of process, including being put into little dinghies on boats, little dinghies in the middle of the night and being pushed out into the river. It sounds like a scene out of a thriller. It is not. It is what happens almost every night in Greece. But again, we see the abject failure of the European Union to share the burden of flows of migrants and asylum seekers towards Europe. The last point I want to talk about are unholy alliances in dealing with migrants and asylum seekers. And the one I particularly want to focus on is Italy and Libya, although, again, there is collusion of the European Union. Effectively, what's happened with Italy and Libya is that there is a political agreement between the two countries to work together to prevent those who are moving from Libya to Italy in search of asylum and in search of economic possibilities. There are many refugees, asylum seekers and migrants from sub-Saharan Africa who end up in Libya because Libya is one of the closest places geographically to Italy, and they try and seek to leave Libya to find some kind of refuge in Italy. Now, Libya is not a party to the UN Refugee Convention. It has no asylum system, and it has extremely little respect for human rights. But what we see is a joint patrol system between Libya and Italy that arrests people at the sea and takes them back to Libya, even though Libya has no facilities for refugee protection or asylum protection, asylum processing, without any effort to see whether or not any of those who are on the boats seeking to get to Italy have the possibility of a genuine asylum claim. And that's one way, of course, that the European Union keeps its processing offshore, prevents people from even setting foot in Europe, and seeks to wash its hands of the problem. Next month, we will put out a report on the Ukraine and similarly show the ways in which the European Union are seeking to do offshore processing in a country that has extremely little respect for the rights of asylum seekers, migrants and refugees. And so let me conclude there. The continent that gave birth to Kant and the continent, as you said in the film very eloquently, you talked about Europe as seeing itself as the, I can't remember the phrase you used, but sort of the where history was born and civilization was born, is in fact, you know, in many ways one of the worst examples of the failure to meet the cosmopolitan ideal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your really impressive presentation. Thank you also for reminding us what the European Union also is, because in the morning it was, I mean, not all the time, but sometimes hailed as an example of collective, starting collective security and so on. I mean, it's much worse even. Not only that the far right is anti- migrants, but mainstream politics is using the fear of normal citizens of the far right to impose a very closed policy, and EU is becoming a fortress. And on the shores of this fortress, behind the walls of the fortress, really thousands of people are dying, really dying, no? And it's even worse. I mean, we are not, you mentioned Greece. I don't know if you said that European Union countries until very short time ago also brought their asylum seekers back to Greece when they had entered through Greece, the European Union. No? They stopped now because, yeah,
I think
the conditions are so appalling that they say we cannot bring people back there. Well, you said also the question of aspiration. You said you are pro-commitment, so you are pro-aspiration, of course. What you did not explain, you hailed Kant as a human rights activist. How do you cope with his restrictions? I mean, his plus, we could say, is that he speaks about rights. I mean, but he says it's not for love of people. He says it's not philanthropy, it's rights. But this is a good thing. But it's a very restricted life, a right. So how do you, I mean, go along with this?
Nearly 20 years ago, I was working in South Sudan in the rebel-controlled areas, trying to promote human rights and humanitarian law in areas controlled by the Sudan People's Liberation Army. And then you talked earlier this morning about some of the complexities of promoting rights. Promoting rights where there is no government, where the ruling authority is a guerrilla force, is even more complicated, as you can imagine. And we struggle to find ways of promoting... it's a little bit of a roundabout answer, but I want to sort of explain my thinking comes. We struggle to find ways of talking about the Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law, which with an army which was 5% illiterate, and which had never heard of Geneva, let alone the Geneva Conventions. So we developed an approach that was rooted in traditional values. And we began the conversation by talking about certain traditional values, including traditional values that governed conflict, because there had been conflict in Sudan for thousands of years before the Civil War at the time. Conflict usually revolved around land and cattle. And so we would start with it was like a round table, and we would have this conversation with religious leaders and members of the guerrilla army and community leaders and others about what were the traditional values that underpinned conflict. What were you allowed to do? What were you not allowed to do? And then we went on to talk about why those values had changed and how those values had changed and why those values had changed, and then what could be done about it. And so, you know, a lot of the values, and they varied from location to location because the ethnicity of the groups varied, but by and large, the majority of the principles that underpinned the traditional approach to conflict was compatible with international humanitarian law. You weren't allowed to kill women, you weren't allowed to kill children, you weren't allowed to kill the elderly people or priests. The only person who was a legitimate target was the warrior on the other side, and he was a young man and he had to be armed. You couldn't steal food, you couldn't burn down houses. Now, there was one thing that you were allowed to do, in particularly between the Dinka and the Nuer, the two main ethnic groups in South Sudan, is you are allowed to kidnap, what's the wrong word, to take, to abduct, kidnap, their daughters, and take, not to harm them, You take them back to your home and you bring them up as your own daughter, because when they reach marriageable age, you will get dowry for them. Because in South Sudan, the husband's family pays the wife's family. So they were an economic resource. So in these sessions, we would go through this whole process. And at a certain point, I would say, you know, we have a problem here, because for the most part, your values are totally compatible with the Geneva Conventions. So in a sense, don't worry for a moment about the Geneva Conventions. Think about why you have left behind your own values, because most of them are very good. But of course, I always had to point out that you can't kidnap girls. It's not allowed. Sorry, you can't do it. And I remember one person standing up and saying to me, very angry, you know, Mr. Levine, you know, our traditional values, this is not a self-service cafeteria. You cannot help yourself to what you like. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, you can, and you do. Mm-hmm. And I would do the same with Kant. I help myself to what I like. Okay. And what I don't very like, you know, sorry, he's dead. He's not going to answer me back. Okay. So that's how I
thank
go.
You. Perfect answer. Professor Barkan, do you want to add something before we go? Okay. So, please. No, Professor De Kaik.
Thank you. Just a brief comment about the sequencing idea, which I think is a bit of a running thread in the conversation. I think that barring the cessation of conflict, the immediate cessation of conflict, the history of very clearly isolated policies, some having to do exclusively with security, some having to do exclusively with development, and some having to do exclusively with justice and rights, is not a brilliant history, which of course is not to say, again, that the cessation of conflict is unimportant and that there are certain quote-unquote security-related measures that tend to be taken before others. But outside that immediate margin, I think that we should rethink, and I think, in fact, we are rethinking whether that sort of complete separation is sustainable or not. And my general impression is that it is not that, for example, even in terms of the effectiveness of security forces, it's very difficult to attain those when the security forces are populated by former perpetrators, that those who are supposed to be served by the very same security forces do not trust at all. So it's not a mystery that reporting rates in countries that have unreconstructed security forces are as low as they are. So that's just an illustration. But I had a question about the sort of unholy alliances that you're talking about, but within national borders, and in the following sense, and obviously this is a question of empirical research, and it's a plea for someone to do it and for someone to let me know if it already exists. I haven't done it. My general impression is that the alliances between mainstream parties and far-right parties not only compels the mainstream parties to accept policies on immigration and refugees, which we would find objectionable, but that it goes much farther than that. In other words, that the spillover effects of the alliances is precisely the wedge on the basis of which extreme right-wing parties start influencing their larger coalition partners on a range of issues that has absolutely nothing to do with refugees and displacement. So the consequences of the unholy alliances are really go far beyond the immediate issue of the single issue extreme right-wing party. But again, this is a question of empirical fact, and I wonder if you know of anything that has done studies about the impact of coalitions of this sort on issues that go beyond refugees.
It has not even to be coalition forces, and also just being there. You want to answer? I think we have enough time still that you, if you want to react immediately to an answer, you can. Or I collect it. It's up to you.
I don't know of any such research. It's an interesting thought. And it's led me to think about something else I might come back to in a second, but no, it's a good question. I actually was thinking about the news this morning that a Republican leader had backed down on an issue of earmarks for spending bills based on pressure from the Tea Party, with nothing to do with refugees, of course, but just what you were saying, how a force on the right is really pushing on mainstream conservative thinking in this country at a political level. And it's a very good and pertinent question, but I don't know the answer.
Couple of points. First of all, about sequencing. I don't think that security, development, or justice are places, so you don't get there. It's a process. So obviously I agree with every word you said. If you don't, there is a minimum. I don't know, I won't recognize the minimum in the abstract, but presumably in a context I will, where you need to have certain level of security in order to begin development and in order to have justice. And obviously if there's no justice, there's no security in the long run. So it's not that I suggest, but I think that I was trying to imagine what Kant would have, from his perspective, and what he would have thought about this kind, when we talk about the three definitive articles, that the three of them actually go together, and that he sees the democracies or the republics as a precondition. That was the comment in that. The unholy alliances, I thought actually the perhaps a different unholy alliance, but I thought that you also referred to it, is not so much with the right, not within domestic internal unholy alliance, but actually the unholy alliance between democracies and dictatorships, or between democracies and countries. So it's the Italy, Libya, it's the US or the West with Vietnam in the 70s and with Cambodia. So it's these kinds of where prohibiting the illegal migration, having a prohibition on the right to exit, so to speak, that is the most dramatic unholy alliance, because while you keep to the convention, to the refugee convention, to the letter, the substance of all those 40-some million that are displaced and tens of millions that are not displaced, because even that would be a privilege for them, but just repressed, that I think is a really unholy alliance that is at the heart of the problem of what we're dealing with.
And really leaving the dirty job to them. I mean, you don't make your hands dirty, but you know what happens to these people. Please, Francesco.
I wanted to broaden up a little bit this concept of citizenship. I just came back from a trip in the Emirates, where only 15% of the population are locals. And as we know, there is a strong resistance, of course, there to enlarge citizenship rights to anybody else. That would completely transform the society in that place. What I'm trying to say is I wonder if what is happening and the dimension of what is happening from refugees to other cross-border movements has a magnitude that our society is not really able to cope. They're not able to adapt at the same speed that these trends are in some way happening in a way that Kant couldn't even predict. Don't read this as a justification rejecting asylum in any sense, but I'm trying to understand what pressure is this on societies at large, independently if you are on the right or left spectrum of the political spectrum. I wonder if you have any reflection on this.
If you agree, I want, as long as it's possible with time, I want to keep this a little bit like a conversation, not only collecting. So, I mean, at the end, we have perhaps to collect.
Sure.
Okay, please. You want to respond?
Okay. I think that the dilemma that we have with human rights is that we think about it in the singular, but the plurality of rights and the incoherence of rights is often not the subject of either philosophical or empirical formulation. So what you are describing is the tension between, and another comment is that we always privilege, and I'd say always, we always privilege individual rights over group rights. The exception is when we do it otherwise. And by that I mean is that By that I mean that self-determination is recognized as a primary right, but when it comes to conflict with individual rights, we tend to privilege the individual rights over the self-determination. So, and we really are not conducting a discourse or public conversation that actually addresses the questions of conflict between rights. And we hope, I guess, that they'll just fit with each other. But the example that you give and much of what I alluded to when I made the comment about democracies being both the object of desire and the source of abuse is that those things, we can't take the people out of the democracies. We have to deal with the democracies and the fact that just because we will say these are right-wing parties and they are evil and therefore it's distortion of the populace vote, it's distortion of the democracy is a problem. I'm not sure that I have a solution, but the question is, if you have in one election after another parties that have ideologies that object to many of the rights that we think are essential, this is a dilemma that we are finding with, and we need to get a response to that, not just to dismiss it as a distortion. But it's not that I'm proposing a solution, I'm just highlighting a tension between different rights and the mechanisms that we have how to deal with those.
I don't have a solution. I just have another dimension to the problem. Your point on the Emirates, you talked about 15%, I think you said, of the population are citizens. I mean, we've done work on migrant workers, particularly migrant construction workers. I think we found something like 95% of the workforce is migrant. You know better, you've just been there, obviously, which creates extraordinary challenges from a rights perspective, particularly when there are so many problems with the system at the moment of recruiting construction workers, the payoffs they have to make, the lack of protections, issues of working hours, and no right to collectively bargain, no right to strike. So our efforts are very much focused on how to ensure basic rights for these migrant workers, rather than the broader question you pose, I think, about kind of the broader societal relationship. In that sense, I think we are much more pragmatic and accepting the current system, but trying to make sure that rights are protected within it. Just on the issue of unholy alliances, I mean, just to say a word on our work around the UAE and protection of migrant workers, because some of the buildings that are currently being constructed in the UAE include those commissioned by New York University, the Louvre, and the Guggenheim. So some of our advocacy work has tried to focus on getting those institutions to recognize that workers are building buildings in their name, and obviously in many cases extremely prestigious projects in their name, to standards which would not be acceptable in their home countries, and to try and point out the hypocrisy of that. And I have to say we struggled. It's not been an easy ride, even with an institution like NYU that one would assume had a certain commitment to some basic values that would play out globally and not just in New York City itself.
May I say, if somebody has to contribute just to the point, please tell me. No, this is, please.
No, very quickly. But this privilege of individual rights just triggered to me this idea that it seems to me that at least in Europe that individual responsibility very often become collective responsibility. And what I'm saying is an Italian Rome who raped someone in a city, immediately it becomes a responsibility of the collective Rome community, the Roma community in Italy. And there is no, in the society, there is no capability to understand that individual responsibility can never be extended to the community. If there is one individual criminal, okay, fair enough, something can be done about it. But this extension of the individual responsibility to the whole community, I think, is a problem. And a lot of parties and groups exploit this link, right? And the individual responsibility becomes the collective responsibility of a full group. And that's, I think, is a big problem. Easy to exploit, of course.
Well, of course, this is one of the characteristics of neo-racism, I would say, to transfer the qualities of an individual to a group. I mean, without the group being a race, even, I mean, a religion or whatever, no? But we see it all the time. So Mr. Toro is not here, so the next one on my list is Mr. Lupel.
Slightly different angle, but my question is exactly on this issue of the individual and the group, and it's really sort of a question for Professor Barkin, because I'm interested in this idea of the politics of hospitality that you mentioned in your talk, and this idea that, well, we often speak about hospitality as a matter of individual rights. It's actually groups that are displaced. And a notion of rights without some sort of political backing is indeed miserable comfort, as you say. But I'm not quite sure I'm understanding where you want to take it then. Is it the suggestion then that asylum law and such should then be more based upon groups as opposed to individuals, or that there's something missing there? And then what would a global system of based upon some sort of ocean of group rights look like? And is there then a sort of a definitional problem then of how do you know who's in the group, who's not in the group, who actually is worthy of being protected under the system or not? It's easy to – one of the virtues of defining rights by the individual is that, well, it includes everybody.
There are three methods that the UNHCR, it's repatriations, resettlement, and asylum, that and transfer to a third country. And I think if I have a recommendation, specific recommendation, that would be to put the displaced at the center rather than the other stakeholders, which is the situation at the moment. So, for instance, the questions of the right of return is very much validated as, although it's never implemented for minorities, it is kept as a right because it is very much tied to the questions of self-determination. And the questions of the movement, of the national movement, is very much part of the definition of where the right of return has to be. And I can elaborate it. I just don't want to take too long in it. I think that if instead of the nation as the group, the refugees as a group would be, the displaced as a group would be, and rehabilitations would be focused, then we go back to what Ian was saying in terms of the burden sharing. And the resources would not be, this is not my responsibility because they haven't come to my borders and I was able to intercept their boats and put them in Guantanamo. And therefore, under international law, I am free. It's that the questions, addressing the crisis in its total globality has to become part of the international responsibility. So the UNHCR has to focus, I think, not on the legal definition at the moment of the legal responsibility at the moment, as I mentioned before, I think actually is inhibiting the solution for refugees. And so there's obviously greater emphasis that has to be on resolving the causes for displacement and of rehabilitation and greater support, whether it's through humanitarian or not through humanitarian, through development aid, to the countries of refuge. What succeeded in the 70s in Southeast Asia was that the countries, that the frontier countries, were not left holding the problem, because there was either they were returned, but most of them were taken as asylum to the third country. But at the moment, the situation is that the focus is on a very small, I think that Ian, you mentioned about 5%. There are 1 million out of 45 million people displaced that are asylum seekers. So according to the international system, the international legal system, only 5% of the displaced are even candidates for solution, let alone the situations being resolved. So I think the challenge is to see it more comprehensively. It's not, that doesn't mean to say it's manageable tomorrow. But the idea is not to focus it through the narrow prism of the Refugee Convention and the legal system, because that doesn't address the vast majority of the displaced. Certainly those that are aspiring to be for movement.
I would ask Professor Braidotti, and then I think we should start to collect the questions, but please.
I'm a bit out of sequence, I'm afraid, but okay. It was in response to Professor de Greef's point on to what an extent this unholy alliance between the center and the far right has already affected the change of policies. One area where this is felt very distinctly is women's and gay rights, which are at the core in the EU, at the core of a new cultural clash of civilization that is completely perverse, because it runs along the lines that our women and our gays are free, emancipated, respected, and really successful and part of society, comma, but their women and their gays and their lesbians are oppressed, and because those people have no human rights. They have never had Immanuel Kant writing Perpetual Peace, so they really don't know what's going on. And this is a very specifically European refrain, which is really almost a commentary on the legacy of the Enlightenment. I believe it works very differently in the UK and the USA, I hope for you. And it's doubly perverse because it not only completely reifies the non-Western women, non-Western women's movements, non-Western gay rights movements, completely deletes them, but it also falsifies the situation of women and gays in Europe, creating a very over-optimistic picture of what the situation is really like. A country like the Netherlands, that certainly has sexual freedom at the heart of our culture, has actually a model of liberation that I call emancipation without power. There are zero women in position of decision-making in the labor market, in politics, in the corporate world. There's less than 8% of professors are women in the Netherlands. I think Austria is doing relatively worse. It depends on what you are looking at as the indicators of the status of women and gays. So now we're working on a different paradigm. Instead of taking sexual liberation as the term by which we would index the emancipation of women and gays, we need to take other indicators. And I think that alone is a blow in the face of the Enlightenment legacy and the Kantian legacy, whereby it would be individual autonomy, including sexual autonomy, that would actually index the degree of freedom of individuals. We need to revise that and actually stay off sexual rights, because they're contaminated by this perverse clash of cultures and discuss of civilizations.
Yes, we stay with that because I have several already contributions. I think, I don't know if I pronounce your right, your name Italian in the Italian way, Fieschi, right?
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, okay, so you want to say something?
Yes, it's directly related to that and also addresses your question. And I would say that we do note a very similar phenomenon, even in the UK, where notoriously the far right hasn't been quite as notoriously successful as elsewhere. But there's a new group called the English Defence League. The English Defence League essentially positions itself as defenders of the Enlightenment. We want to protect gay rights. We want to protect women's rights. Now, admittedly, once you see them, given the kind of latex balaclava type militia that they look like, you don't exactly take the claim at face value. But the fact is that, yes, it's a very similar discourse that's moved away from sort of standard racism and shifted really the debate and the attack to the cultural level. But I just wanted to say another quick remark. When we talk about, you know, the alliances between the center and the far right, I think there's no need for such alliances. And if we look at France in the 1990s, and actually the changes in citizenship law, the changes in the rights of asylum seekers and refugees in the early to mid 1990s, one could very easily argue that that was a direct consequence of the impact of the FN on the French political scene. There was no actual alliance. The FN was very ephemerally represented in the French National Assembly for a couple of years, but actually there was a massive impact on the French political landscape and on the French policy landscape when it came to immigration and asylum. Same, I think, you know, if one were to read the Roma crisis in France, yes, of course, this is Sarkozy's populism, but really it's also a reaction to an FN that's gathering steam on the right of Sarkozy, that's about to elect a new leader, that's about, you know, and that's given about 18% of voting intentions. 18%, that's, we're 2 years from French presidential election. However, that's a very high number. And I just want to conclude on this. I would say that, therefore, one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that given that there is no necessity of alliance, but simply the presence of these far-right parties in particular political systems that have, you know, shared and differing characteristics, I think it's very important that we note that the enemy of cosmopolitanism is actually not the far-right, it's populism. And that's the populism of the center, be it, you know, it could be center-left, could be center-right. Now, I know that the challenge comes from the far-right, but the fact is that the people for whom cosmopolitanism is a dirty word and is an elitist conspiracy are the populists, both on the left and on the right. And I think it's important that we keep that in mind if we want to fight it effectively.
Thank you very much. Professor Braidotti addressed Pablo. Do you want to answer something or not? So it's, you want it.
I'd like to ask a question of Professor Braidotti. In the context of what you just said, which I thought was very interesting, I would love to hear your thoughts on the burqa bans that have been pushed in France and Belgium and are being considered in other countries. Because it's an issue that we at Human Rights Watch have struggled with. When I say struggled, it's clear to us what Human Rights has to say about that. But we've been fascinated by the fact that when we have spoken out against the burqa bans as infringements on women's autonomy and rights to freedom of expression and religious expression, we've been criticized very strongly by those who are often close allies on virtually every other issue. But here we're clearly out of step, and I'm just interested to hear your thoughts about the kind of dynamic around the place of Muslim, you know, what it says about the place of Muslim women in Europe, particularly in those countries.
It's a huge question. There is a conference at the end of January in Amsterdam, which we are calling sexual nationalism. It's about the nationalization of sexual rights that will do justice to the complexity of the question. The ban on burqa is a specifically French problem, and it really has to do with the French take on the legacy of the Enlightenment, which is a very interesting one, considering they're not Kantian by any real long shot, but they have their own sort of esprit républicain to come to terms with. We all know there are 327 women that wear the burqa in France, and Sarkozy made a law especially to gather populist consensus. I think the populist thing is absolutely central here. The Netherlands, the entire Northern European social democratic bloc will not pass such laws. It's unimaginable. So there is a typical, again, populist perversion of a human rights cause, a feminist cause, a construction of the Muslim woman as the symbol of oppression, and a manipulation of that construction for the sake of humiliating Muslim countries and continuing our clash of civilization on the one hand, and also self-congratulatory construction of how very free and emancipated our women are. And I think that that is really a European perversion at the moment, and I think it has everything to do with the legacy of the Enlightenment. And it's a complicated one because it right across the board, since Pim Fortuyn in the Netherlands, people know that Pim Fortuyn is the great martyr that was assassinated, is never really talked enough about the fact that he was a very, very out gay of the totally flamboyant offensive kind. And I'm speaking as a gay person and somebody in favor of gay rights. Offensively, flamboyantly gay. And that aspect is completely sort of put aside. We're not allowed to talk about it. And he converted entire sections of our population, people who have never had, you know, a gay rights bone in their entire system, the working class of the port of Rotterdam, for Christ's sake, and homophobic and anti-feminist genetically for generations, overnight are reborn as champions of enlightenment because of their love for Pim. I mean, episodes like this have not been studied sufficiently, and they're a complicated one because a whole generation, let's say, the Simone de Beauvoir kids, and then the women and men who are in the Emancipation Commission, who set government policy, who are in the EU, are completely on the side of Sarkozy, defending the Enlightenment, defending secularism, because only with secularism and Enlightenment legacy will we have emancipation and gay and women's rights. This is a nightmare. I mean, I remember meeting Simone de Beauvoir as a graduate student, and then, in the 1980s, deciding she was a woman of a different generation. Now she's from a different planet. It's like really, it's a perversion of an entire history of thought, an entire political legacy. And I think it needs to be studied as a virus that takes different forms in different countries. Italy, that has no real claims to anything, just goes very basic populist, is my country, so I can rubbish it. Very basic Berlusconi saying, better be a womanizer and a Viagra inflicted pedophile than to be gay. Good old healthy, wholesome homophobia. In the present context, it's almost a welcome relief.
He actually gets told off by a next neo-fascist. That's what's incredible.
And then the fascists become the defender of gay rights. Yeah, this is what I mean. There is I think it's a perversity, and I think we need to study it as such. And I believe that liberal system, UK, USA, experience it differently, if not at all, although you're suggesting that the UK may be going the same direction. I think Immanuel Kant would have a fit if he saw some of this. But come to Amsterdam at the end of January. Joan Scott is also coming to speak on the politics of the veil, addressing specifically the French issue. She's one of the great scholars on this from Princeton, of course.
Thank you very much. Also, I unfortunately think that you are not right if you say it's a French problem. I mean, I wrote some time ago a commentary saying that I'm more afraid of tendencies to ban things than about the five burkas. We have 5 or 10 in Austria, no? And you cannot imagine what happened. They almost killed me, but mostly from the left. It was very interesting. Yeah. So, and thank you also for mentioning the name Kant, because we, of course, are far away, but it's perfect. So I'm afraid now we have to go back to, to not answer, not discussing every question, but to collect the contributions. And I would just ask you to start, Mr. Frier, and then Mr. Toro, Mr. Rauchbauer, Mr. Stadler. Okay?
Okay, so very quickly, for the sake of brevity. But I must note that I noticed the plaques seem to be up a lot to the right, but we are not right-wing. Just a quick thing. Though I did my PhD in peace studies and conflict management with a focus on psychoanalysis of issues, and all those taken from the West and in Europe, I want to make a point about the situation of refugees, even looking at countries which may not be designated as the ideal candidates, because normally I've looked at the trend of the conversations here and it seems to be like Fortress Europe and people trying to move in. But I have countries like Nigeria and Ghana. I just went through 4 countries in West Africa over the past 2 weeks, where you have refugees from Sierra Leone, Liberia, residing there. You have a country like Senegal with refugees from Cote d'Ivoire. It's just due to the language links, French and English. But I want to pick on something in that regard to what Catherine just said about populism being the enemy of we thinking, giving thought to the fact that populism could rather be the enemy to cosmopolitanism. And I'm thinking what fuels the populism could be the context of this socioeconomics. Societies become averse to hosting the other when they feel they don't have the capacity to host them. The right wing feasts on this. We have a global slump. What do you expect? And I'm not saying it makes it right, but as we discuss Kant, we should also look at the context that we are dealing with. I've seen societies in West Africa that are normally very welcoming, thinking, look, these are hard times. We can't host people who want to come in at this time. And if you have sections of society that seek to exploit the socioeconomic context to do that, it seems to be real. And that is an angle that it should be looked at from. And I thought I should just flag that in this discussion. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Toro.
Thank you. I wanted to make a talk about the point that was brought up by Professor Barkan and also Mr. Levine. It's the issue of circuitization of migration. I believe that the first Security Council resolution to speak about migration as a threat to security and peace, of international peace and security, was Resolution Haiti around 92-93. I think it was 93. And it characterized the potential massive migration of Haitians to neighboring countries as a threat to peace and international security. Since then, several UN Security Council resolutions on Bosnia, Somalia, and other countries as well have categorized migration as a threat to international security. Now, and they have invoked Chapter 7 to deal with this situations. So what they have done is that they've turned migration from a political issue into a security issue. Now, this is just a sort of theoretical proposal, but the Copenhagen School of Thought says that, you know, once an issue becomes a security issue, then it's taken off the political agenda and it's dealt with under an emergency situation where the rule of law is no longer, guides people in their actions. So you've taken the migration issue from one area to another. What you've also done is you've through several speech acts, several official statements, you turned what had usually been termed irregular migration into illegal migration. So through words, you're also turning migration into something that is illegal, it's beyond the law, and therefore it should be tackled with measures that are also beyond international humanitarian law. So this is one issue I wanted to mention. I wanted to bring to the table something that, I mean, I've seen very, it's not very commonly reflected, but liberal theory and its principle, it's about the free movement of goods and the free movement of people. Now, we have a system that promotes free trade all around the world. And so we promote free movement of goods, but we restrict severely the free movement of human beings. So there is some contradiction or some sort of, you know, I don't want to say hypocrisy, but it's not true to the liberal speech if you want to be loyal to it. And I also, I just wanted to bring, put out a statement, and I'm taking this from a Chantal Mouffe. She's a Belgian philosopher, and this is, I think it's very hard to swallow, especially for human rights activists. But could we have an international system of law based on the idea of regional poles and cultural identities federated among themselves in the recognition of their full autonomy, instead of having a cosmopolitan democracy or a cosmopolitan entity, we would have a federated regional and cultural body where every region's autonomy would be respected. I just want to end with that. Thank you.
I'm sure we will hear something about that. Please.
Yeah, I would just like to return to the text of Kant for a short while and go to this point. We've been somehow talking about this cosmopolitan citizenship and its centrality for Kant's theory of peace, which strikes one, I think, because on the one hand, you have said it is a very restrictive use of this right to cosmopolitan citizenship, which he really restricts to visit and not to stay in other countries. And on the other hand, the centrality of this point, it is the necessary condition, one of the three necessary conditions of peace. It's the third definite article. And I wondered why it is so central then for Kant. And maybe it has to do with, he makes this comment about that originally every human being has the right to be at any other place in the on the globe. Yeah? So it, in a sense, it for him, this right to global citizenship undermines borders or points to the artificiality of the borders itself. But I think also that he's restrictive because he points out also to contemporary experiences of abuses of this right to visit. He points out to the whole colonial experience. He talks about Japan and China and how the European colonial powers abused this right to stay. But on the other hand, I think he warns of the dangers of a world where this exchange of people, of restrictions to travel, restrictions to visit. And the odd thing is that Kant himself never traveled in his life. He always stayed in his hometown, Königsberg. But he argues in this text not only that people should travel and that they should visit other countries, but that this is a necessary condition for peace, which I think is very interesting. Points maybe also to some programs like the Erasmus program of the European Union, which has asked many of my generation have undergone that to really encourage people to spend some time in a different country. Thank you.
Well, you remind me a little bit of the, you know, modern Islamic theologians who propose to read the Quran, I mean, not as definite articles, but in a historical context, no? And to see what to include in the view the development, the possible development. So, Mr. Stadler.
Well, let me follow up. I think the core issue for today's reading of Kant, which is the hospitality issue. And I think the two presentations that we have heard were extremely inspiring and informative. Because the central discussion, in my view, is about, on one hand, the issue of human rights, which is and should be non-negotiable everywhere in the world. There is no autonomy from human rights as such, but as opposed to the issue of citizen rights. And we agree we are talking about millions of people who actually should have human rights, because even if they are refugees, even if they are displaced people, but this is the minimum standard that we should aspire at least to achieve. But on the other hand, there is an unwillingness to grant to such refugees, again, we are talking about millions, citizen rights. Now, I remember one of the practical solutions, and of course it's impossible, or states are not willing to grant refugees full rights under the Geneva Convention of 51. So one thing I remember from the Yugoslav tragedy, and in particular in the Bosnian War in 1992, when hundreds of thousands Bosnians actually left Yugoslavia, many of them through Austria, was that the Austrian government invented a so-called de facto refugee status. That means the government didn't give them full protection under the UNHCR refugee status, but they were basically, they had legal residence status, and they also were, which I think was the most important thing, allowed to work. This worked for a few years. It was then later abolished because of xenophobic attitudes, but I think it was a very workable solution, and I would really be interested to hear from you whether there are other examples of such a nature. And then let me just make another observation now, very briefly, about the rising xenophobia, but also in particular Islamophobia. I think this is a trend that we face everywhere, not only in Europe, but also in the United States. And in Europe, for me, as appalling as it is, I still can sort of see it as a process, because Europe was de facto a net exporter of migration and has never, or European countries have never conceived themselves of being net importers of migrations. They talk about they talk about in Germany, for example, by Sarrazin, that or the idea of the German chancellor of Leitkultur. You know, it just shows that there is a process of a cultural change in Europe, where France, Germany, Austria, Italy, you name the countries, grapple and have huge difficulties of understanding that the status quo, which means in Europe, I think at least 40% of all Europeans in Europe are not ethnically clean anymore, of Italians or French, but they are already have a migration background. But this reality has not trickled down to their to the public consciousness. So there, I have, as appalling as it is, as in Europe, I also have a little bit understanding for this political process. But then if we look, for example, at Arizona and this law about personal identification, which is, I mean, I think one can call it racist, then we see actually a global trend of fight about this distribution, actually about the issue of citizen rights versus human rights. So, sorry for this long explanation, but I would be really curious to learn more from you on that. Thank you.
So, you have to answer to a lot of questions and give the final statement for this panel. We are at the end of our time. Who wants to start? It's up to you. We also can throw a coin.
No, please. I think we'll settle. I think that the tension that exists, first of all, perhaps let me start with a particular, and then I'll try and make a general statement, sort of a general observation, not a statement. There's a theme that runs through the questions, through the discussion, of which the particular cultural, political manifestations conflict with some general cosmopolitan norms that we would like to uphold. And I think that this is a tension that I tried to comment very briefly earlier on, is the tension between the democracy as the source of sovereignty and the democracy that produces results that we don't like. And that is something that is obviously very difficult. I don't have a good solution for it, but I think that it's a little, how should I say, a little, it's not explored enough in terms of the, of our response to that, and just reducing it to populism or right-wing categories that we like to dismiss, as opposed to democracy, something that we like to uphold, is part of the rhetoric of naming things, and which needs to be addressed. The example that you gave of the refugees from Bosnia, again, it's the nation, it's the notions of namings. Germany was the largest recipient, the largest haven for refugees from Bosnia at the time. Then, when the war ended, the notions of not returning refugees to places where they face risk, because a lot of them were moved, Germany returned a lot of them under the category of, they became IDPs. They were not returned to their place of origins, they returned to a place where their ethnic minority was a majority. And so I think that we're talking about 200,000 or 300,000 people that were returned, strictly speaking, because the definition, the legal definition was different, it was legal. But in practice, they were removed. They were repatriated from being refugees to being IDPs, and I think this is the tension that we have, and that's, I think, very much part of what we are facing in all of the conversations. The questions, the relationship between hospitality that is more cosmopolitan And the locus of hospitality, which is regional, local, specific, with a specific culture, and in a world that changes very rapidly, as in and is unable, and I don't think that we really have good theoretical responses. We have rhetorical assertions, but the tension between full citizens and between citizens that receive full human rights and the notions that there are some human rights, some humans outside the system, we're not quite well bridging those differences. Maybe I should stop here.
Thank you. I feel I've taken more from the conversation than I've given, so thank you. It's been very, very thought-provoking, and I've enjoyed the conversation. For some reason, as we talked, I remembered from way back reading in the Bible that Abraham, it was said, he had four doors to his tent, so that whichever way it was pitched and from wherever the stranger came, the stranger could walk straight through a door into his tent. Such was his notion of hospitality. It just made me realize how far we've moved from Abraham's days. We may have progressed in some different ways, but not on that. So just a few thoughts in response to some very interesting comments. I mean, the point about the impact of the global economic slump is very well taken. You're absolutely right. I didn't say it as well as I should, but that was why I sort of wanted to emphasize the point about burden sharing, because I do think that there are genuine demands created by flows of refugees and migrants, not only some of the things that we've talked about in terms of the discrimination, but one area that we didn't really talk about was kind of economic and social rights, the education of refugee children and migrant children, and the provision of healthcare. We've done quite a lot of work, for example, in South Africa, where you have 1.5 million Zimbabweans who have fled both the oppression and the brutality of Robert Mugabe's government, but also who have fled the collapse of the social and economic infrastructure in search of work, in search of healthcare, in search of education for their kids. Something like 35% or 33% of those aged 15 to 45 are also HIV positive, which creates a whole other layer of pressure. So one is acutely aware of the burdens that these flows create. Although in that context, in answer to your question, Professor Stadler, when you asked about regimes that have created or that have been created for temporary protection, that's not actually sort of formally refugee status. South Africa is one that created some kind of, I think they called it temporary protection status for Zimbabweans. So they weren't given full refugee status, and they certainly were not given citizenship rights. But there was a recognition of their presence, a recognition of their rights to certain basic economic services, and a recognition of their right not to be sent back to Zimbabwe under current circumstances, which is an extraordinary gesture when one thinks of it. We've been very critical of many governments, but one does have to recognize that to recognize those rights for something like 1.5 million was a step forward. I want to finish with just a comment on kind of the securitization of the discourse and the comment of Professor Toro, because it was interesting what you said about the concerns that refugee flows are seen as threats to peace and security, and the worry that therefore they would be approached through a very securitized approach and one that was oblivious to rights. Very often when we are pushing our concerns about a particularly bad country, particularly repressive country, take Zimbabwe or take Burma, where we've done much work on both countries for several years, we struggle to take the debate on those countries and the need for change and political pressure on those repressive regimes to the most important political body that exists globally. And that body, the most important and most influential, is the Security Council. The problem with trying to take a country like Zimbabwe or Burma to the Security Council is the Security Council won't touch it. And it won't touch them for two reasons. One is because they're not prepared to take on such a political hot potato. But they hide behind that by saying the Security Council exists to deal with threats to regional peace and security. And unless until you can demonstrate that Zimbabwe or Burma are threats to regional peace and security, we won't touch them. So we find ourselves trying to work out whether or not the flows of refugees from those countries justify us being able to insist that the Security Council deals with them. And we're very conscious of the fact that we're walking a fairly... We have to be very careful, because on the one hand, we want to use those refugee flows to convince the Security Council that you can't shy away from this issue and you have to take action. But clearly, we do not want to create a political climate in which they are seen as threats and their rights somehow can be marginalised. So there are, you know, we're sort of, there's a balance there, because in the real world of political advocacy, you're trying to address both issues. But I thought your point was really important, because in the broader migration discourse, the word control, it's all about control. And in that discourse, it's noticeable that human rights activists are rarely invited in. It's an issue for economists, and it's an issue for those with security concerns, particularly, obviously, 9/11. One of the great achievements, I believe, of the human rights movement in the last 25 years is that we have gone from being always sort of outside the door or at the end of the table to becoming seen as people who had a right to sit at the table, whether the discourse is on governance, on peace and security, on development, on humanitarian concerns, and on corruption. And I think on these broader issues of refugee and migrant flows, we are moving closer to the table, but need to get more central if we are to have the impact we need and if we are to protect the Kantian ideal here. So thank you all.
Well, thank you very much for this great session. I mean, I apologize with my speakers that I made you really work a lot by having you had to respond to so many questions directly, but I think it was to our benefit here, and I thank you very much. It was very interesting. I learned a lot. And I pass, of course, the chair to Mr. Stadler, who will do a wrap-up for us and also discussion still.
Well, if there is any bad panel, then... I mean, I'm sure the first one is the last one, and I will definitely not be able to do a wrap-up, but I will ask you to help me identifying a few issues that we maybe have raised today for the first time, that we have learned from this discussion. I think definitely I can say that having engaged as one of the organizers in this enterprise of rereading the Perpetual Peace text, that we have had a lot of fun, that we have gained a lot of insight. I think it's also good to reread the text at an age where we are kind of executives and not students, because it demonstrates actually the responsibility to us as acting individuals who, however small it might be, make a change in their everyday decisions, rather than being a student in the bench just reading such a text theoretically. But I have basically thought when I reread the text that this is a kind of a Ten Commandments text of an Enlightenment program that Kant has very courageously conceived in 1795, an agenda that has actually been worked off to at least, I would say, one-third. I'm not going to detail the Ten Commandments, which I think one can distill out of this text. One-third that has been not achieved yet at all, and at least one-third where we can say the glass is half full or half empty. Maybe if I just look very... I mean, and one of the things that struck me today in the discussions, actually, were more the themes that we have not talked about than the themes that we might have talked about. And, for example, one of the striking... elements of the first debate that we had this morning was that in the panel on collective security and the implications for sovereignty, the Minister of Defense of Austria has never even mentioned the word of sovereignty, but he has really defined in a very practical term what his threat to security is. And only in the second intervention we heard then a very realist approach of sovereignty still being the main guiding principle of international relations. So I think I found this also interesting in itself. Anyway, so I'm not going to into the Ten Commandments, but that are kind of positively resolved. But if you look at Article 2, no state having an existence by itself shall be acquirable by another state through inheritance, exchange, purchase, or donation. We haven't talked at any stage about, of course, the economic foundations of the world system and the still unchallenged power of international corporations who actually can buy, if not states, but so at least decisions. We haven't talked about Article 3 in respect to military-industrial complexes, which are still very important all over the world, not least in this country. No national debts and so on, paragraph 4. We haven't talked about international economic policy prescriptions by neoliberalism and the international economic policy regime, in particular of the IMF, as of the 70s, and then particularly also in the 80s, really interfering in the sovereignty of nations. And of course, I mean, we have very recent examples, for example, Greece and Ireland, where we can discuss glass half empty or glass half full. Well, having said that, I think it's, let me see, where are my notes? It is important to rethink one of my favorite quotations of Kant, which Aaron Levy has beautifully displayed at the New Museum. I think you talked about this morning. And it runs, "The social relations between the various peoples of the world have now advanced everywhere so far that a violation of rights in one place of the earth is felt all over it." Now, I think really when we talk about the 45,000 refugees that live in Greece, or actually don't live in Greece because they vegetate rather there, and of many other examples, we really can see very drastically that this program of Kant in terms of a global community of awareness has actually not been yet realized. This is, of course, also the reason why we are here, why we have subject to discuss among each other. But this is, in a way, both a sober but also an encouraging point of view, because also we understand that from this program there has at least a lot of progress been made. So this would be my very erratic observations on the whole day. Of course, there was very interesting second panel about the definition of peace as opposed to the definition of collective security, and you were all witnesses of the highly inspiring last panel, which I don't even want to dare to summarize here. So I invite you to just tell us what is it that struck you, what is it that outraged you, what is it that you think should be on the agenda of a future discussion? That's, I think, the main question that we can engage in the next 15 minutes. Thank you so much. Signore Mancini.
Grazie. Just one thought, and this is something actually I grapple every day in my own work. And I think if there is a sort of a common trend throughout the three sessions, is this incredible inadequacy of our institutions to deal with these issues. I mean, in the last 215 years, it's amazing what happened in the world, and especially since the end of the Second World War, in terms of institutional development at global level. I don't have the numbers here in mind right now, but I mean, the multiplication of international institutions in the last 45, 50 years is just absolutely astonishing. At the same time, it seems to me our conversation here is pointing toward incredible institutional gaps. I'm not even going to the normative one, but institutional gaps in being able to address security issues, rule of law. We talk about building capacity, the level of decision making. Can the Security Council really making decision for rule of law in Guinea-Bissau? In the last session on the issue of human rights and asylum and so on and so forth. It's remained a big question because to me it seems that we don't really lack the institutions out there. I think we do have all the tools, but the way we use these tools is still not adequate. And maybe it is about what the press and the World Bank call to create a Facebook of the global institutions. A place where these institutions are actually networking with each other, actually connected with each other, rather than stovepiping every issue in a different way, as we tend to do within the UN. You know, we divide by topic, right? Each one takes a piece. I don't really have an answer, but I find interesting that throughout our discussion, I think we still lack a sort of international capacity at all levels, at regional levels, sub-regional levels, and of course at global level, to be able to respond to these kind of challenges, despite, you know, the progress that will be made. So I don't want to sound too negative at the end. So I think progress has been made in a tremendous way, but still a lot of work has to be done.
It's really... Adam follows up. Just follows up on that because I think it is actually sort of for a wrap-up session appropriate to sort of ask what next and how to get from here to there. We talked quite a bit about the aspirational ideals of perpetual peace and the shortcomings of implementation, and it made me think something that was a couple of people I think. Today mentioned the surprising sense of humor of Kant in the text. It actually begins with a joke that references a Dutch innkeeper's sign, which is actually the origins of the title, To Perpetual Peace, and has a picture of a graveyard, which suggests that, you know, yeah, you'll get perpetual peace when you're dead, right? Like this is a perpetual peace. And so, you know, how to get from here to there? Well, that might be is sort of one answer, but I think, you know, you keep reading in Kant, and actually the answer for Kant, how the progress toward perpetual peace, how you can see it, envision it, is actually will be a result of providence. His whole philosophy of history that leads towards this, and I don't think we can rely on providence, frankly. And I think that what that means is. On the other hand, for us today, perpetual peace or the arrival of collective security, or however you want to call it, depends upon politics, and that's sort of the task. That is not an answer, but I think that's where we're at.
I want to take that phrase, your quote, and just change it slightly. And you talked about how a violation of right, or as Kant says, a violation of right in one place of the earth is felt all over it. What we see is that a failure to respond to a violation of rights in one place is felt all over the world. We recently honoured, last week, 2 weeks ago, we honoured, every year we honour human rights activists from around the world who've displayed exceptional courage, and we honoured an Egyptian, a young Egyptian human rights activist. And in his speech he said, you may be asking yourselves what you can do to protect human rights in Egypt. I will tell you, deal with the human rights problems in your own country first. Because as long as there are unchecked human rights violations being committed by the US, people like me in Egypt and other countries around the world struggle, because when we go to our governments, they turn around and say, well, they get away with that in America, so why should we worry about it? I think Kant was wise, but I think it's the accountability element that is the most critical thing, because when there's a lack of accountability, particularly in more developed and more powerful countries, it sets an incredibly negative and pernicious trend. And I think just in the last week, the admission by President Bush in the release of his memoir that he personally authorized torture, and the utter and complete failure of the authorities here to follow up on its obligations under the Convention Against Torture to hold him accountable for that admission, clearly sets us back in dealing with torture in 75 countries around the world.
Thank you. Martin?
I would like to pick up the question of where next, and you said we shouldn't leave it to providence. We should turn to politics. I think Kant also suggested we should also turn to public discourse. Politics alone is not enough for Kant, and I think that's a big challenge nowadays. If we just think of the role that foreign policy plays in our public discourses, even in Europe, how much the European Union is debated in each European country, or how little it is, of the relatively little role foreign policy, for example, has played in the last congressional election here in the United States. I think for Kant, it's a very important point, and that is also part of his idea of republicanism, to connect the citizens with what is happening in the world. And I think that remains also a challenge. And I think our project here, to connect theoreticians with practitioners, is one step in this direction. But of course, the real challenge is going to be how to connect the citizens to the international world.
Yeah, Mr. Hoffa.
Tesco said, but looking at it from the flip side, because if you look at the proliferation of international institutions and what they seek to do, I think we've come a long way. I see myself as one who is much more conversant with what is happening on the African continent, and so I try to harp on that always, because what Kant had to say has a lot of bearing and relevance to what is happening now. I talked about the evolution of positions from the OAU, which will not interfere with issues within sovereign states, to the adoption of the Constitutive Act of the African Union in 2001, which now makes it possible for the continent itself to act as a group and interfere in issues within states, human rights related, etc., which was unheard of 20 years ago. And so I want to look at it this way, that when it comes to the evolution of norms, of values, etc., and we talk about Kant and what he had projected, we should also be looking at what the positive trends that are coming up and what can be done to support that. And that is where the plugging from the regional levels, sub-regional levels, into the international values that are beginning to converge should be well maintained. It comes both ways. Responsibility, like someone mentioned, responsibility from the micro level and responsibility from the macro level as a global community to support such efforts. That's what I've got to say.